This is the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. Most of our discussions on politics, economics and culture are now also available to watch on our YouTube channel. This week, Boris Johnson passed a bill in the Commons to raise national insurance contributions in order to pay for social care. Is the Tory party now the party of high taxation? What does conservatism now mean? Tim Montgomery and Maggie Pagano discussed.
Tim, I think we're all still reeling from the extraordinary announcement from the Prime Minister yesterday. Who would have guessed that this was a Conservative Prime Minister? And just to prove the point, have you seen the Daily Telegraph headlines? Yeah, highest tax take since the war. But not just that, and I think this is the really important bit, the tax raid on dividends punishes, you know, the wealth creators, the risk takers. So were you as surprised as the rest of us by what was announced?
Well, I was. Of course, it has been trailed, Maggie, for a few days now. And so I think we could have kind of expected it. But it is still amazing to hear, you know, a Conservative Prime Minister get up in Parliament, break an election manifesto promise without any real sense of regret or apology. And it's also, I think it's interesting just watching how the opposition have reacted as well. You know, Guido Fawkes, you know, the blog site, has remarked that, you know, there's been no Labour, senior Labour politicians on the news, on the Today programme or whatever, over the last couple of days. And I think they're sort of wrong-footed about it as well. You know, they're looking across the aisle and they're seeing this Tory government raising taxes and spending money as if there's no tomorrow. And I'm not quite sure they know how to respond to it. And I think, you know, we can talk about the individual issue, and perhaps we should. But I'm in London today, hence a slightly unusual environment. I'm sorry, the lighting isn't perfect here. But I was at dinner last night with 20 or so Conservative MPs, and they're stunned by it. I don't think there'll be a problem in the vote today. I certainly have said to people, what's the point? There's just support it. It's going to pass. Don't get yourself a reputation. But there's sort of a sense of the Conservative Party has lost its moorings. There's a bigger thing. Yes, this is an individual act that brings it home, but what does the Conservative Party stand for anymore? What's its fundamental beliefs? And I think because of Brexit, because of a lot of voters' support for Brexit, for a lot of Tory MPs got their seats because of Brexit, Boris Johnson has been given a benefit of the doubt that few other Conservative leaders would have got. But it's allowing him to take the country and the party into really unexplored territory. I'm doing Talking Pints with Nigel Farage on GB News tonight. And so I should really be having a pint with you now, Maggie, in preparation.
I'll pretend to be Farage for a moment. Exactly. So, Tim, how can you be a member of this party any longer?
Exactly.
Might be the first question.
But in a way, his absence, now he's doing this TV programme rather than being leader of UKIP or whatever, there is nothing to the right of the Conservative Party. You know, there's no consequences for the Conservative Party vacating that traditional sort of conservative Thatcherite territory at the moment. And I think maybe until there is some sort of political consequence for that, we'll continue to get this leftwards, big government, centrist, you know, drift of the current leadership.
Socialist, you might say.
You might say that.
Two questions, Tim, from what you just said. I'm very surprised that you would say to those Tory MPs who are stunned and don't like it, or have objections to it, that they shouldn't rebel. Very surprised, because you just said there isn't anything to the right of the party, but surely the Conservative Party has always been a broad spectrum, and you've always got Thatcherites on one side, indeed our health secretary, supposedly, and others within it. So it should be a place for debate. Now, secondly, surely Boris's Brexit dividend has sort of, He's had that now, really. The honeymoon is over. and particularly post-COVID, we should be into an era of proper parliamentary debate about ideas. Now, let's assume we should raise taxes. My objection, actually, and I think objection to a lot of people in business, is that this was the wrong way to do it. There are better ways, many, many better ways. But, you know, most of the focus has been on national insurance, a tax on jobs, which it is, and it will be carried by the lower paid. We know that too. But the dividend tax on the 6 million small businesses, contractors, freelancers, company directors, I mean, it doesn't sound much, does it, 1.25? But it is eating away. And I mean, dividends are already taxed, or certainly on the stock market, you know, listed companies are already taxed about three times anyway. So you may as well say, people just say, well, I'm going to stop working. You know, I'll just go on benefits. I mean, human nature is such that they won't stop working. But why would you dull people? Yeah. I just don't understand. Do they not understand basic economics? That this is where the wealth will come from to pay future taxes. It's quite a simple formula.
Yeah, well, I think the lesson for this, there's rumours, Maggie, of a reshuffle in government tomorrow. I don't know whether it will happen. But I think one of the lessons is that we need Maggie Pagano as Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think would definitely would improve the Conservative character of the government. But you know, I honestly do not have a good explanation for why they have done this. And you know, I love Sajid Javid; he's a good friend of mine, and you know, lots of people I have huge respect for are in government, and I just don't understand why he has done this and why he's bought into it. It's not conservative for me in any way. There's no talk of personal responsibility. There's no talk of the kind of business incentive structures that you've just mentioned. There's no talk of the family. You know, we're talking about an issue like long-term care, and we're not even talking about whether we're supporting the family in any significant way. So I think what has happened inside, this is the best explanation I can offer, is that I think Boris Johnson has been very concerned that there is this growing reputation that he has. He doesn't take tough decisions, that he leaves decisions to sort of fester. And I think maybe there was just this sense in number 10 that they needed to look like they were taking some bold action in a key area of government policy. And of course, you know, older voters, property owners worried about passing on their house to their kids. That's a big constituency for the Conservative Party. I think they may have chosen this issue for that reason. But, you know, it comes after a period when lots of people are very unhappy in the Conservative Party about the whole Afghanistan debacle. There's a sense that just the government doesn't really have much of a sense of direction. And so I'm afraid this is just the latest warning sign, really, for Conservative MPs that something isn't right in the party.
I mean, and the big elephant in the room that we haven't addressed, Tim, is will this extra money, 36 billion over 3 years, most of it, as we know, will go into the NHS, whether they will put a portion aside for social care. But I think that certainly if it's going to be hypothecated into this sort of, you know, fund, we should see a full audit. I think they need to show where it's being spent and how. And you hit on a very good point. What about families who do want to care for their elderly at home? Why weren't there incentives to do that? Why haven't they looked at some sort of social insurance policy that people can take out? I mean, I'm not sure this is going to address the issue at all. And that's my biggest worry.
Yeah, no, mine too.
Now, in July, Helen Joyce, the Economist journalist, published her book called Trans, When Ideology Meets Reality. Ian had a conversation with Helen this week about trans activism, gender identity, and sex-based rights. Here is the whole interview.
Tell us where the book came from. Why did you feel now that this book on this very difficult, controversial topic is necessary?
I mean, Ian, you're a journalist, so you've answered the question as you've asked it. It's very controversial. So when there are topics that everybody is shying away from, that should tell any decent journalist that they should look at it harder. I stumbled into the topic in 2018 just by a chance request from a commissioning editor. And the thing that astounded me about it more than anything else was this silencing, this approach totally unlike anything else I've come across in a fairly long journalistic career at this point. And, you know, I've written about highly controversial topics like doctor-assisted dying, paedophilia. I was a foreign correspondent in Brazil for a while, and I had to write about, you know, political corruption, gang murders, the deforestation of the Amazon. And never before did I experience this approach where simply asking a polite, reasonable question of an appropriate person in clear language led to me being, you know, treated like I was a neo-Nazi, that I was a fascist, that I wanted trans people to die, that I was just completely outside the pale. So that was what intrigued me, in fact. And the more I looked, the more I became convinced that there was a serious problem, and that problem is not trans people. As you know, because you've read the book, in the introduction I say, this is a book about an idea. And that idea is one that is disagreed with vehemently by plenty of trans-identified people. It's the idea that what makes you a man or a woman is solely what you say about yourself, that bodies are now passé, that we aren't even born male and female. Some people really say this. They say sex is a spectrum, or that sex cannot be differentiated from gender, which is some sort of social construct. So the more I looked, the more I realized that this idea that dissolves reality and puts an ideology in its place was something that was very harmful for a lot of people. And I mean in public policy terms. I don't mean that trans people themselves are harmful. I mean the way that they're insisting the world, and by they I mean the trans activists, not trans people, the way they're insisting the world be reworked to include this ideology, you know, the end of single-sex spaces, male people competing in female sports, male rapists in women's prisons, children being medicalized when they're gender non-conforming, the more I realized that there was something here that we all are concerned about. This is not an issue that's just to do with trans people. It's all of us.
So where does this come from? What are the historical roots of this movement that you describe in the book? What are the origins?
I mean, hard to summarize, but I would, in the usual analogy, is a perfect storm, isn't it? We arrived at this moment a sort of century after doctors in Germany, in fact, had started to try to reshape these very rare people that they would find who felt strongly that they were really meant to be the opposite sex, to reshape their bodies to look a bit more like that of the opposite sex. And so there's that medical movement. And then around the 1990s, it kind of joined streams with big changes in academia and in politics. So in academia, things were taking the postmodernist turn, as they say, shifting away from thinking that there is some reality behind the discourse, and that discourse is what creates reality, that the words we use have a power beyond, you know, beyond anything else, really, that it's not just that words describe reality and partly shape our social realities, they are reality. And then I would say the third element I would highlight would be left-wing politics taking the identitarian turn. So thinking about people as membership, as members of identity groups above anything else. Of course, we are all members of identity groups, and all politics always has been identity politics to some extent. But this shift sees people as solely that and arranges all politics in terms of these stated identities. I think that's a reasonable, if overly flattened, summary of how we arrived at the point in around 2015 when this thing sort of metastasized, and suddenly we find ourselves with laws and, you know, media guides and so on suggesting that it's extraordinarily bigoted to refer to sex as if it's a real thing.
It does speak to the power, doesn't it, of academia or of ideas, in that lots of people will have had that experience at sort of university in the 80s or 90s of seeing those postmodern theories become fashionable in a playful sense, kind of everything you know is wrong, the power of language. And it was for some people in English literature or in covering literature in general and history and philosophy, it was an intriguing idea, but it was very much a sort of minority sport, wasn't it? It was a conceptual play rather than an attempt to completely redesign society. But it's from there, somehow it's captured something which appears to be the mainstream. Then we'll talk about how mainstream this is, and the polling that you refer to in the book is absolutely fascinating. What sort of response have you had since the book was published?
In one respect, absolutely what I expected. One aspect of the book is the outright lies, libel, vilification, defamation, harassment, and threats that anyone gets who dissents from this ideology. It hasn't been as bad as it might have been, but there's been a lot of really unpleasant mud slung and some extremely bad faith criticisms, people quoting a few words out of context to suggest really terrible things about me. But, you know, as I say, I expected that, and I wrote about examples of this happening to other people in the past. On the other hand, it's gone very well beyond even my wildest dreams. I mean, I've been 4 weeks in the Sunday Times bestseller list, and the New York Times astonished me by reviewing it, completely astonished me on publication day in the US, which was September 7th. I had no idea that was coming. They're very good at keeping their secrets so that authors can't in any respect try to influence reviews. And it was a quite positive review. There were some criticisms which were well taken, and but overall it really said it was worth reading. And since the New York Times is the sort of quintessential example of, I think, all of the trends that we've discussed, you know, that's where these graduates who come out of university convinced that reality is discourse and absolutely focused on their version of social justice above everything, and who think that what journalists are meant to do isn't nose around the place and find stuff out and so on anymore, but actually to be activists and to tell stories that move the world closer to the version of the world they want. And not by uncovering bad things, which is the way we always did it, but by basically giving an incredibly one-sided version of what's happening, because that's the right side. So yeah, it's been really positive. I've had lots of people say very nice things about it. And, you know, every journalist wants a big story, and every journalist quite likes a story where nobody else is doing it. So there are other books starting to come out, and a few before mine, but not a journalistic one until now. I think there's going to be a lot more, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, J.K. Rowling in, I think it was 2018, got involved, and you refer to that. It was a very brave thing that she did. But the intensity of the attacks on her, almost beyond, well, certainly beyond reason, and there was a feeling of a witch hunt.
So it's far beyond reason, because the point is it isn't about reason. As I slowly realised when I was writing the book, this particular sort of social justice identitarian movement doesn't see any of the benefits of free speech that people of our generation would have thought were foundational, in fact, and foundational to journalism and to academia. So they're not really very interested in testing ideas or in finding ways for people who disagree with each other to coexist comfortably. They believe that they found the truth. And if discourse creates reality, then it's essential to silence people who say things you don't like. They regard that as an actively good thing to do. Even if you threaten people, it's good. Even if you have to get people sacked, it's good, because you're remaking the world. You're remaking the world with words. And so words are invested with this intense power. So when J.K. Rowling is saying something, she is making a reality. Of course, that's partly true. I know that. We're social animals. But they see only that. And they don't see it as a call to themselves to tighten up their arguments or to try to consider whether she has a point. They just see the need to silence her. And of course, she's extremely powerful. She's probably the world's most popular author, extremely rich. It's hard to silence her. Her publishers aren't going to drop her. So they had to be vicious.
To what extent do you think is the impulse, the campaign, is it religious or religious in character, a replacement for religious? I've been reading a lot recently about nonconformism and the politics of that period, and a belief that they were sort of breaking with a corrupt a world that had become corrupt, and that they were creating something pure, and that, as you say, they had discovered the truth. There are parallels, aren't there? I'm not comparing it to a major global religion, but possibly with religious sects or breakaway movements, just in terms of how they behave. Yes. And talk about other people.
I mean, it's quite cultish. I found a book that was, it's called it's Totalism in Under Mao. I forget the exact title, but it was the word, Robert J. Lifton, he created the word totalism. And he's the author who created the phrase thought terminating cliche. He looks at the way that language that's enforced in social groups can be used to direct people's minds away from dangerous thoughts in a very cultish manner. You know, it's so the policeman can't be outside you in a cult. The policeman has to be inside you. So as soon as you find yourself veering towards a point where you might say, gosh, that actually sounds quite sensible. I don't maybe think it's a great idea to sterilize children who are gender non-conforming. Something has to step in and stop you. And what that thing is mantras. So the thought terminating cliche is a thing that you say to yourself that's the start and end of any conversation in Lifton's term. And so when I saw that, I got shivers down my spine because I just heard trans women are women, trans men are men, non-binary people are valid, no debate. So it sounds like a liturgy, but it's also, it's more specifically a mantra, and it's being said to soothe and quiet one's own mind, which is the way that cultish religions behave. Those that will cast you out if you try to leave.
And the key mantra in this, of course, is the word TERF. Can you explain to people where that comes from, the origins, what it means,
sure, how
it's used, and also is it a misogynistic term?
So it stands for trans exclusionary radical feminist. And first of all, radical feminism is a specific strain in feminism. It just doesn't just mean like super feminist. It specifically means feminism taken back to its roots, radical in the sense of root, and looking at feminism as a liberation movement from the patriarchy. I wouldn't describe myself as a radical feminist, I should say, although I agree with many aspects of it. So that's the radical feminist bit. But because radical feminists see feminism as a liberation movement, only women can be feminists. Men can only be allies. You know, the same way that, you know, the Black Panthers wouldn't have seen a white person as a suitable member. They could only be allies. So it's something that can only be said to female people, which is interesting because actually most people who commit transphobic violence or who say horrible things to gender non-conforming people are men, not women. And yet this trans exclusionary radical feminist or TERF is a word that's used solely about women, really. So the trans exclusionary bit, I think they're deliberately playing on the fact that people will hear it and think that these nasty cows are trying to keep trans people out of safe housing or healthcare or life, basically. Actually, they're just saying you're trans doesn't admit you to the opposite sex class. So your statement does not change your sex. That's the exclusionary bit. I would say that the phrase TERF very specifically functions like the phrase apostate or heretic. So it's a loaded term. On its surface, you could say, well, it's just descriptive. Of course, we know that descriptive things like shortenings for the word Pakistani or, you know, a certain mispronunciation of the word Negro, you could say these things are just factual. We all know they're slurs. So there's that aspect of it too. But I think more interesting to me is the way that it's used to prejudge the argument. So I'm an atheist, but if a religious person calls me a heretic and asks me to call myself a heretic, what they're asking me to do is to accept that religion is correct and that God exists, but I'm denying them. And so it's a loaded term in that sense.
And how big is this movement, do you think? How would you, is it possible to quantify trans activism? Because I suppose there's the activist part of it, and then there's the support network and parts of social media and younger voters where those ideas are popular. How big is it?
Well, if you ask people clear questions, the ideas that I described at the beginning, the sort of gender identity, Trump's sex ideas, are extremely unpopular. Like once you make clear to people that when you say a trans person, you don't mean someone who's gone through very major surgery and had a medical diagnosis. You just mean like that if you say you're a woman, I have to accept you're a woman. If I say I'm a man, you have to accept I'm a man. People, and then you remind them that this may mean a person with a penis in a women's shower in the changing room. Suddenly people get very unhappy with this. They get less unhappy the younger they are. And interestingly, young women are the most likely to go along with it. Though even they, when you remind them, when you say this means male people with penises, naked in showers where there will be children, totally naked as well, are you still happy? A lot of them change their mind. So not a popular idea when it's really brought down to brass tacks. I would say on the activism front, it's kind of the current thing, isn't it? So the same people, and I would count myself as I think I would have been one of these people, the same people who would be very keen on, say, ending segregation in the American South, or people who would have campaigned for gay marriage, A lot of them, I think, have unthinkingly moved on to this as the next civil rights movement, because it sounds like it, and at drive-by speed, it looks like it. It looks like the next oppressed minority. And people don't think about the implications for everyone else, which weren't there for Black people ending segregation or for gay people being married. Those things don't affect the rest of us in the same way. So yeah, there is a fairly large activist movement, I would say, among young people. But what has really pushed this is what I call the Upton Sinclair crowd in the book. So Upton Sinclair famously said that it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. Yeah.
Author of The Jungle, a great sort of progressive author, very influential.
Yes, and it's a phrase that you often hear cited because it's just so telling. So there's a whole bunch of people whose jobs depend on this. All these people in HR, all the diversity, equity and inclusion types, this enormous increase in academic administrators. All of these people need to be constantly finding bigotry in order to root it out because their jobs depend on it. And I would say that big companies are also quite keen on this because it's a very performative, low-cost sort of social activism that they can just, you know, rainbow wash things. They can just stick, you know, an all-gender sign on the women's bathrooms and, you know, nobody suffers except the women who now have nowhere they can go, that they're private. But that's much easier than trying to do like genuine inclusion and diversity, which would require, you know, supporting disabled people or really cleaning up your supply chain. So yeah, I think there's this confluence of people for whom this is a very handy job creation scheme and big companies that are all for it because it doesn't actually require them to change anything and yet makes them look good.
For someone who's, if someone's skeptical about your argument, they might say, fine, but let's quantify the threat. Is there actually a threat to women's spaces and sex-based rights when the numbers of trans people are so low?
Well, if by trans you mean people who've undergone full genital surgery to try to reshape their genitals to look like those of the opposite sex, it is a small number. And if you talked about only those people and it was a gatekept process, it'd be a bit like witness protection. Witness protection allows people to really lie about themselves and who they are with the backing of the government for a very good reason. Like, you know, there's a higher cause. And that's the way it used to operate. And, you know, most of us will probably not meet a trans person in our lives. I'm sure there were people who still weren't happy. But, you know, then you could have a serious argument about how, you know, how serious an issue is this, really. But now it's just self-declaration. And since, I mean, I just keep saying this, you know, you could be a woman. I can't say. I meant to ask you your pronouns when I meet you to check whether you're a woman or a man or non-binary or gender fluid or a demi-boy or, you know, there's hundreds of these identities. I'm not meant to be able to tell. Then I can't tell anybody. I can't tell if somebody who's in a changing room or entering sports or, you know, whatever is meant to be there. So suddenly you just don't have any single-sex spaces. And moreover, if you say that what makes you a man or a woman is what you say about yourself, people say, well, what am I meant to say about myself? And straight away you end up at stereotypes. So there's now education for which pretty much every child in every school in Britain, private or public, is being told all of this stuff. And what it ends with, what children hear, and I've really looked at the educational materials, what they are told and what they will hear is that stereotypes are what make you a boy or a girl. So a little boy who's on his way to being a gay man, there's a strong link between being gender non-conforming in early childhood and growing up to be gay. That little boy is likely at 5 or 6 or 7, you know, precisely when he just doesn't like rough and tumble games and all his friends are girls. And he's starting to maybe think, why am I a bit different from the other boys? He's been given the answer. It's because really you're a girl inside. And that puts these children on the path to sterility, major medicalization, you know, when they could just grow up to be fine, just fine. Gender non-conforming people, probably gay, who cares? It's fine, they're healthy. So yeah, it affects all of us. And that's why I come back to the thing, this is not about trans people. It's about the idea which screws up everything.
Why do you think it is, and you may have just answered the question there just in terms of education, but is there something broader going on? Why is it that so many teenagers, particularly girls at the moment, are expressing, it's described as gender dysphoria, and seeking to transition? Why that gender imbalance?
So that's a very recent thing. It's only happened in about the last decade. Like, until around 2011, there weren't many children seen by gender clinics at all, and most of those who were seen were very young, highly gender non-conforming boys. And the research, at least a dozen studies in different places over decades, showed that if you didn't encourage these children to believe they really were members of the opposite sex, most of them would desist. They decided that they were fine with the sex that they had, usually on the onset of puberty or just before or after. So that was the historical situation for children. And then sometime around 2015, the chart would show this steady, tiny number, maybe creeping up a bit, of little kids, and then whoosh, along came teenage girls in large numbers. So I think you have to understand about teenage girls, that they're the ones who spent a lot of time on Tumblr before Tumblr got cleaned up. And they also picked up a bunch of other things there. Tumblr used to be very, very lax on self-harming and on encouraging anorexia and eating disorders. So there were all these communities where girls were teaching each other incredibly disordered behavior. And gender was one of the things, I mean, of the kids I talked to who had desisted, the detransitioners I talked to who were in their late teens and 20s, they all cited Tumblr. They said that, you know, you went there and, you know, you were maybe a bit unhappy, you felt uneasy in your body, teenage girls tend to. You maybe don't like being early sexualized by men, like if your breasts grew early or something, you maybe don't like periods, you think you're fat. You know, you might have self-harmed, you might have become anorexic, but actually you land at this idea that the reason you feel so uncomfortable as a girl and so unattracted by the stereotyped and pigeonholed version of girlhood that we have, that means you're probably a boy. And so off they went. The role of fashion in and contagion in mental syndromes cannot be overestimated.
Where does this end, do you think, in terms of public policy? Because watching, you mentioned detransitioning there, and obviously there have been some very important, famous court cases, and things seem to be shifting in that direction. But does this end with a public inquiry? I mean, I keep reading some of the stuff, thinking, in 5 to 10 years' time, a government is going to have to hold an inquiry and explain why these theories were allowed to take over public policy for the best part of a decade.
And longer.
And presumably some of the people involved will be due compensation as well. Is that how it plays out, do you think?
Maybe here. I would say that in the States, I'm very worried that I think they're going to paint themselves into another public policy corner, which America is very good at. Like, if you think of gun control and healthcare, America left these things so long that it got itself into a situation that it couldn't get itself out in the same way that other rich countries could. Like, you're never going to get rid of guns in America now. And the healthcare is twice as expensive as everywhere else, which means that, you know, really having comprehensive healthcare for everybody is just unbelievably expensive. America is where all of this started, in particular on the left wing in America. So blue states and at the federal government level and in American corporations and nonprofits. I think America could end up in a place where they have basically abolished recognition of sex in law, and that it's very hard to see a way back, because once you give people something and you call it a right, it's hard to take it away. I don't think it's a right for male people to go into female spaces. I just don't think that's a human right. But if you said it is and you've given it to them, it's hard to take it back. So that's America. We're the sort of next level. We got infected from America via academia, large corporations and NGOs. Because America is the globally dominant culture. And those places are now very entrenched. And I think some of them are going to have to fall. I would point to Stonewall in particular. It's extremely malign, its influence. Via its diversity champions scheme, it makes companies go down this crazy direction. Like, to be called a diversity champion, you have to really destroy women's rights. And, I don't see how we get out of it without, right, taking down some really malign actors. I hope that we have something like a public inquiry. I mean, there are kids and people who are going to be due compensation, but one of the difficulties with relying on the medical route, like, you know, suing a bunch of people good and hard in order to encourage other people, is that it's very hard to sue somebody for medical malpractice who is following international best practice. And there is this awful organization, WPATH, that is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. It's really very activist. And its guidelines do say, you know, the correct treatment for kids who say that they feel like members of the opposite sex is immediately say they are members of the opposite sex, change their pronouns and dress, put them on puberty blockers, send them towards life as a sterile trans adult. So, you know, doctors here could say following orders, Gov. That was the international best standards. I would point to the schools, though, as crucial in all of this, because in one respect, they are indoctrinating the next generation. In the other, inside that, there's something useful, which is that so much of this has been driven by fashion, and nothing's fashionable if your teachers are telling you. So a lot of these trans-identified kids latched onto it as a way to rebel and a way to express difference, if you've been told this stuff since you were four. So that's a sort of long answer, because I can't quite, you know, there's different strands to it.
And what specific policy changes would you like to see? How should this complex, difficult subject be handled in practical terms?
So I don't know that it is that complex, and actually British law is pretty good as it is. I would just like to see the Equality Act properly applied. So that's the 2010 law that swept up probably about 100 laws against discrimination in one way or the other in employment and provision of services. It created 9 protected classes, one of which is sex, meaning male or female, really meaning the proper meaning of the word, and another of which is gender reassignment, which is seeking to present yourself as something other than your natal sex, short version. But neither of those trumps the other. None of the protected characteristics trump others. And if you are overly protective or supportive of one, you may be committing indirect discrimination against another. And if equality lawyers do their job properly, and public bodies, which are meant to have a public sector equality duty, do their job properly, then you must protect both women's sex-based rights, privacy, safety, fair competition in sports, the right to request somebody of the same sex in intimate situations such as care and medicine. And you must protect trans people from being bullied or harassed or sacked or denied healthcare or housing. Those things are not incompatible, and the law was set up to do both of those things. And then there's this separate issue of healthcare and the guidance for dealing with children. And that's a disgrace. And I really, really hope that the Keira Bell hearing has put us on the right path there. So that's this woman who transitioned to live as a man and then detransitioned and successfully persuaded the High Court that the Tavistock Clinic, where she was treated, was treating children and giving them treatment that those children simply couldn't have the maturity to consent to. So if that ruling stands, I think on healthcare, we'd be pretty much sorted.
Speaking of the law, of course, it looks as though the law, subject to votes in the Scottish Parliament, as though the law is about to change at Holyrood, and there's a big campaign building there. That changes the dynamic in the UK as well, doesn't it? I mean, do you think
in Scotland,
what's your latest information? Will that pass? Will it happen? There seems to be, having visited Scotland recently and just talking to people, there seems to be a lot of quiet anger.
There's a lot of anger. I mean, as soon as you explain to people that teenage girls are going to be kicked out of their changing rooms because boys can go into them and strip off, and kicked out of their sports teams because boys can play in them, everybody's angry. Dads are angry, mums are angry, everybody's angry. So nobody wants this. It's just, as you know, Scotland is a very strange place politically. I mean, the SNP doesn't have to have a political platform beyond independence. Like, it's just a broad church. There's no, you know, there's no SNP-ism. And it's everything from, you know, full-blown Marxists right to libertarian capitalists. And so, and they also, as long as the independence question is the overwhelming reason why Scottish people choose whom to vote for, they're kind of safe. Like, you know, Scotland and the SNP are in this endless dance of, you know, the voters don't actually approve, I think, of the way that the SNP runs the country. It hasn't done a good job. They're not approving this flagship policy. But that's still who they're going to vote for if they're for independence. So I do think it might happen. And the strange thing is that some aspects of this, what this is, by the way, is what we call gender self-identification, meaning that it'd be very, very easy to change your legal sex. You would just make a sworn declaration and suddenly your legal sex has changed. If that happens, it will put some Scottish law at odds with things that are reserved to Westminster. So, for example, they're saying that next year in their census, they are going to allow people to tick whatever they like for their sex, whatever they feel like. Well, we've already had a High Court case which slapped the Office for National Statistics down on that and said that it was beyond its remit to do so. So that's Scotland attempting to do something, saying it's going to do something that we already know a High Court has said it can't. So yeah, some collisions there, but they really seem absolutely dead set on it.
Mm. Yeah, and there's also the other factor in Scotland is that Sturgeon is Sturgeon trying to forge a connection with younger voters.
Yes.
So the calculation she's making, I think, is, well, look, OK, this alienates quite a lot of older voters, disproportionately unionist, ageing, and she's trying to equate nationalism and independence with progressive causes, and this is the this is one way to do it. Obviously, it's a policy which the Greens.
It's a very regressive way to do it. Yes.
But yes, progressive in her terms. But it's also a policy that's advocated by the madcap Scottish Greens, who have just joined a version of the Scottish government, who are in alliance with the SNP. So it's one of their big policies. I mean, do you feel, after the experience of writing the book, and people have contacted you, presumably many people privately, do you feel encouraged? Do you feel that, and I'm sure that, I know that has been the case, that lots of people have emailed you and urged you on in this. Do you feel it's going in the right direction? Are you winning on your side of the argument?
I mean, I think winning is a long way away, and there are going to be many battles in between now and then. Certainly right direction. Like it was inconceivable 3 years ago that The Guardian, when in fact The Observer, reviewed my book. Admittedly, they said it wasn't very good, but even to mention that it existed was a massive step for The Guardian / Observer. It's now, we've ended the no debate slogan of Stonewall and others. And I think we're now in a stage where people are revealing their true preferences to each other. So I think we were in a situation that's called pluralistic ignorance before, where most people don't agree with some public policy, but they don't realise other people don't agree with it, and so they stay silent. So this is how regimes, like communist regimes and so on, kept going so long. People thought they were the only opponents, and they went along with it because they felt they had to. So now I think we've reached the point where, for example, Maya Forstatter has won her case. My book has been a big success, despite the fact that, agents and publishers turned it down, saying that, they didn't dare to face down their woke young colleagues.
Really? How much of that did you have?
Oh, loads. Loads, loads, loads. I got dropped by my first agent, who was super excited about it. Like, she really felt that it was going to be so great. And then when she saw the proposal, she said, sorry, I'm too much of a coward. I mean, that was her word. I feel pusillanimous. Sorry, that was her word. And various publishers, and publishers are entitled to sign who they want. It's just, it's quite striking that they thought either it wouldn't sell, or one said that they didn't want to torch their woke credentials. So that was a very telling phrase, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I've been told that some of the book proposals that are out by other feminist women were waiting to see how my book did. So it's going to make it easier to get articles, to get other books. I'm breaking through I'm breaking through the determination not to have me on broadcast media, which has been quite noticeable.
Yeah. Well, that's a great phrase to end on. Torching his or her or they, torching his woke credentials, and that in itself has a kind of Wicker Man, Salem feel to it, doesn't it? Very strange.
Yeah.
Very strange.
This week, in the fourth episode of our new show, Press Review, Ian, Tim and Maggie chose the stories in the media that grabbed them. From the Tory tax wars to Norway's climate election, and from the future of our post-pandemic cities to the decline of Labour. Watch the whole conversation on YouTube, but here is a section discussing Tim's appearance on Nigel Farage's Talking Pints.
Okay, so I'm keeping this in the family, if you like, good Italian style. I haven't watched it very often, but I knew that Tim was appearing with the great Nigel Farage on his programme Talking Pints last night. Only seen it, I think, once before. And I think, Tim, if I may say so, you were the pint with...
Sorry, Maggie, I just poured myself a glass of wine then. But what were you saying, Maggie?
I escaped my family commitments to watch you chatting to Nigel Farage. And as I said, I've only seen him once before. But he does have the nicest conversational style and also very modest. Well, there's something I want to ask you about afterwards. And so how did you find it? Because he has a lovely style, very open, doesn't He doesn't prejudice questions, does he? And so actually he got quite a lot out of you. He got the G word, he got the F word. I mean, you know, you were really very relaxed. So what was it like? You tell us.
And for those who are wondering, the G word was God and the F word was the family. So it wasn't entirely as rude as you might think. But thank you for watching it, first of all, Maggie. And it is, you know, Farage, I think, is now the top rated programme on this new news channel, GB News. And I was incredibly struck, actually. You know, normally you do a media appearance or two and you get a little trickle of feedback. You know, I had at least 20 messages, WhatsApp and text after I did this, lots of Twitter feed. There is definitely, it may not be a huge number, although I think the Farage programme is doing better than both BBC and Sky in that slot. But what is happening, and I think this may be very important for the Conservative movement in this country, is that it's definitely the British Conservative movement is watching this. And, you know, that could have quite big implications, I think, for how the Conservative Party and all of us communicate with each other as Conservatives. So I enjoyed it. It was, you know, unlike the normal TV slot where you get 3 or 4 minutes to say something. I think this was about 15 minutes near on.
A real conversation.
And you can say stuff you can't normally say, like we do in these YouTube videos, just a bit more extended conversation. But yeah, the key thing, back to where Ian pointed us to in the beginning, was I teased Nigel Farage a bit about, you know, why the Conservative Party was less conservative than he or I or any of us probably would want it. And I said, well, trouble is, you're in this TV studio now, not holding the Tory party, to be honest, by being a sort of a campaign, you know, party to the right of the Tory party. And I'm afraid that is a fundamental problem at the moment. The Conservative Party doesn't have anything to its right, and I don't think it thinks there are consequences if it continues to cuddle up to Labour in the soggy centre.
When you say a new party, I mean, we're not talking about head-banging right-wing ideologues, are we? We're talking about sensible spending. And as Ian rightly said, this social care reform could have been Boris's great legacy if it had been approached the right way. He clearly panicked. We don't know why. So what would a new party of, if you like, the right represent? Is it more like the SDP, which we've chatted about? You know, which does put family, culture, traditions together with economically perhaps soft left.
I think the leader of the SDP in Britain, for those who don't know, it's just more like I think it stood in the Peterborough by-election, but hasn't really stood anywhere else. I think it's William Clouston, who's the new leader of it, and it still has the David Owen era, etc. logo, but it's basically just a campaign organisation, really. But if I was to take a blind, you know, taste test, if you like, and was presented with the manifestos of various political parties and asked to choose which one I would support, it would probably be the SDP, as William Clouston has defined it. Now, of course, that's not necessarily, if Nigel Farage or someone was to set up a political party to challenge the Conservative Party, it's not what we would get. Probably get something that would concentrate more on immigration or something than sound money. But I think the general principle still applies, is the average Tory MP looks across at the Labour Party and Keir Starmer and isn't frightened. Boris Johnson isn't frightened. The Conservative Party at the moment does not fear the electoral consequences of the risks that it's taking with its core vote. It can read angry editorials in the Daily Telegraph, etc., and not be worried. I think until there's some sort of electoral operation that challenges them, I'm afraid we'll continue to get the kind of drift that we're seeing at the moment under Boris Johnson.
But isn't it the case, though, that there's a further complication, which is that Farage, who I have clashed with many times and criticised a lot and have a mixed view of, I'm not sure I would have voted for Brexit. In fact, I can tell you I wouldn't have voted for Brexit if Vote Leave hadn't got the designation and the other team had.
Yeah.
You know, he knows that there are lots of moderate Brexiteers, for want of a better term, who wouldn't have been attracted by what he was pushing. However, simultaneously, he's also, I think, the most influential politician of, you know, certainly since Blair, maybe since Thatcher. He changed the course of history, and it didn't matter that he didn't win a seat, and that UKIP didn't win seats under him, and he kept running for Parliament and losing. The point was that he terrified the Conservative leadership. They twice with UKIP forcing the referendum offer, and then again when the Tories were messing up Brexit, and the Tories pulled nine points in the European elections, then that effectively forced the change and made Boris Prime Minister with everything that flows from that. So he's a hugely influential figure. But is he a figure of the right? I mean, he's a nationalist and a populist, and he's ostensibly equated in cultural terms because of his city background and his inclinations with Thatcherism, and he idolizes Thatcher, the notion of Thatcher as a leader. But a lot of his voters they're really of the left, aren't they? Yeah. So, and they're now with Boris. So the Brexit Party voter likes high spending and actually likes high taxes, as they perceive it, on the rich or the well-off, if it facilitates redistribution, leveling up, all the rest of it. So I'm just posing the question. I don't know the answer. Tim, I mean, what is Farage?
I think more than there's lots of stuff I'd come back to you on that, Ian. Not least, I think voters in red wall seats, for example, like high spending when they benefit from it very quickly. So if, for example, they get their universal credit uplift, they're completely in favour of that. They're completely in favour of higher pensions. But actually, I think more than the Surrey stockbroker belt, when they see waste in the public sector, I think they are more allergic to it than the traditional Tory voter. So I think it's a little bit complicated. But in terms of Farage, what he represents, I generally, you know, he annoys me a lot in some respects. And then we had a bit of a disagreement on the programme, Maggie will remember, on overseas aid, for example, last night. You're just completely indifferent to the consequences of cutting that budget. There's a callousness to some of his policies, in my view. But overall, he comes across as a nice guy. He makes populism attractive. It is the drinking thing. It's the cigar smoking. It's just the sense that he has an optimistic view, whereas so many people on the right traditionally are angry, negative people. And I think just him being whatever the agenda he would have, and actually I think he loves freedom, he generally wants lower taxes, he certainly supports the nation state, tough approach on crime, etc., etc. Whatever the agenda, just having a powerful personality that potentially will rob certain Tory MPs in marginal seats of their majority, that's what British politics has had for how long? 15 years? Up until he really disbanded his movement. And now it's not there anymore. And I think we've underestimated the significance of the disappearance of probably Europe's most successful post-war populist from the electoral battlefields. And I think that partly explains why the Tory party, largely perhaps even, explains why the Tory party is behaving as it does.
It's very interesting. Maggie, I was just going to ask you there. I mean, Tim was talking about Farage's popularity. I mean, he's Marmite, isn't he? Because there are, if a quarter of the public has a very positive, maybe quarter, maybe a third, don't know, in terms of the Brexit Party when it was at its peak, there are lots of people voting for the Brexit Party didn't necessarily like Farage. There's maybe three quarters of the country that's allergic to him. Mm. Is that fair?
Yes, but I think if they were forced to watch Talking Pint, several episodes, they might find him more like Marmalade, actually. Because he shows
Marmite versus Marmalade. I think this is a new catch.
Yeah, this is a new divide, really. But it's very interesting. There was something he said during your chat, Tim, which no other politician has remarked upon, whether Labour or on the right Tory, in response to the national insurance hike. He actually said that what this tax has done, it hurts the 6 million small business owners, the SMEs, the freelancers, the self-employed company directors, who provide, his quote was, economic momentum that creates the growth for this country. He said it in one. He gets it. He may have been a city person. He wasn't a city slicker. He was a trader in the metals market, as far as I'm concerned. That's all that sort of, you know, that's trading. That's having to do business, make deals. He gets it. Nobody else. There's no one. I was trying to think, is there anybody in the cabinet today who has run their own business? Yeah, Boris Persis. Good headline. We didn't get good the piece. F dot 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 business in. They had to, we had to chat to the backbench about that.
Well, I look,
I'm that's how business feels. But I'm, not big business. We're talking small business, the small battalions. Was it Burke, Adam Smith? Can't remember. The small
I think it applies to big business as well, which, you know, I think there are times when people who are pro-market, free market criticize big business for its sort of sometimes, you know, tendency to cronyism and all the rest of it. But it's on a spectrum. Broadly, free market people are in favor of companies, wealth creation, and the private sector, and that's what I find remarkable about the last week, other than just the politics, is that it now just seems to be the central assumption across UK politics, across the parties, everywhere, that business and the economy just happens, and it's just there to be harvested as a, you know, in perpetuity, as a source of tax revenue, and it no matter what government does, it's limitless, and business will always moan a bit. But I think what they're storing up in terms of economic confidence and the message sent to entrepreneurs, I think is really negative. I'm at a disadvantage in that I didn't see Talking Pints because I would have watched if I remembered that Tim was on, but you know, I'm allergic to Nigel Farage being on television most of the time. But what he does seem to have done in the reviews that I read of this, and you see it on Twitter reported, and it sounds as though Tim had a really interesting conversation with him, is that he is prioritizing conversation. And that's interesting. I didn't think that he could really do that, but there is that hunger, whether he's doing it or other people are trying to do it in podcasts, etc. People are interested in more than just opinion, talking points and sloganeering. They are interested in a genuine exchange of views and differences.
To be fair to him, Ian, you know, he's had people like me on. People think, well, you're just as bad, racist, Brexiteer, supporting Tory as Farage. But, you know, he's had Vince Cable on earlier this week. He's had Ken Livingstone on. You know, he's not just trying to have an echo chamber. He's wrestling with other voices. But before we move on from this topic, can I just ask you one thing, Ian? The only other way I think that we might be able to pressurise the Tory party, if we're not going to have this sort of political party, is if there is some kind of cabinet revolt of some kind. And supposedly, you know, Rishi Sunak is a Thatcherite, Priti Patel, Dominic Raab is dry as dust, Sajid Javid has a portrait of Margaret Thatcher on his wall. These people who surround Boris Johnson are supposedly the, you know, the children of the lady that gave us the small estate and put us on to the kind of conservatism which people like Alistair Heath and Camilla Tominey are saying has now been abandoned. You're more plugged in these days to all of these people than I am. What do you get any sense that at the top of the cabinet there is any willingness to say enough is enough, Mr. Johnson?
No, I mean No, in short. I mean, one thing he did, one of the cynical, depressing things about the way that this story unfolded was that number 10 dangled the possibility of a reshuffle over the cabinet. So as this was all being forced through in 72 hours, the cabinet knew that there might be a reshuffle on Thursday. Now everyone's saying there was never going to be a reshuffle. Boris hates reshuffles. But when I was out in Westminster on Tuesday evening, the air was thick with talk of who was moving where and who was getting whacked. So it seemed like a live possibility.
That was the reaction editors on Press Review. To catch the whole programme with their weekly pick of global stories and great journalism, go to our YouTube channel. Links to the pieces they discussed will also be in the description for this podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock. This is the Reaction Podcast. Until next week, thank you for listening.